little faith, my friend. We got to help each other through thick and thin. These are trying times that we're living in.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal for the last hour of our show. We're here with our good friend, Jim Tullio. Chicago producer who actually produced that Mavis Staples track. We'll talk about that in a minute. And Mr. Antoine Day, a member of the Exonery Band, which is part of Jim's current project, a recording with five men who collectively spent over 100 years in prison for wrongful convictions. So thank you both for joining us tonight. I want to do a little setup with Jim. 40 years, Jim. I've known you all 40 years in the record business. You're telling me stories I forgot about.
Yeah.
First of all, as long as we played the Mavis track, right. let's start with that.
I wrote that song. Yeah. Jim Weider and I wrote that song.
Uh-huh.
Jim Weider, who was the guy that took Robbie Robertson's place in the band. And that song was written at the last minute. I'd made this record with Mavis, and literally, I think, 2 days before we were going to mix, Weider says, "Let's write a tune," and we wrote that tune. And Mavis heard it and said, "Okay."
Did you? And wasn't there a church choir put in that too?
Not on that one. It was a song called "In Times Like These."
That was that had the choir. Yeah.
We had 65 voices.
That's right, and that was for the Alligator Records project and stuff. So, who all you've worked with? Let's talk a little about John Martin, Steve Goodman,
Richie Havens, Mavis, John Prine. A lot.
Yeah. Yeah, what were the Goodman years like?
Oh, God. Stevie was the best. I didn't really produce much for Stevie until after he died. Mm-hmm. I'd done some stuff with him in the studio, but mostly played with him. I played string bass with him. But he was just the best.
Yeah, yeah.
He was the best.
Yeah, you toured with him. We were talking. I saw you at Pfeiffer Hall in Naperville, 1977.
And we did the Earl of Oldtown every New Year's Eve.
Yeah,
that was tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you grew up. Tell us where you grew up.
Originally Brooklyn and then Atlantic City. And I moved to Chicago in 75. So I've been here a long time.
And what brought you to Chicago?
Believe it or not, I was hired to write music for Playboy magazine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They were starting a video division. They were making video magazines, and they hired me to score the music.
I didn't know that, really.
That's what brought me here.
Really. What music did you listen to growing up?
My biggest influence was probably my father. He was a jazz drummer and a radio announcer as well.
Yeah.
He was my biggest influence, and a lot of jazz. And really the one thing that stuck with me the most is in the 50s when everyone was buying rock and roll records, my brother was older, and he jumped on the bandwagon, bought Elvis, bought Buddy Holly, Bill Haley. My father comes home one day and he throws a record on the bed and he said, "Listen to this. This is what these guys are trying to do." And it was Little Willie John.
Oh, yeah.
And that really sculpted my, my musical life was Little Willie John.
Antoine, you're a Chicago man, right? Did you grow up here?
Yeah, I did.
And same, almost, I want to kind of parallel the questions. What music did you listen to growing up?
Everything. My thing was I love rock and I grew up on Super CFL,
Did you really?
We have FM radio, I love blues, jazz, I grew up on everything. My dad was a DJ and we in my house, my mom sang, so we had everything. Gospel. But rock, I love rock.
Where's your dad a DJ at?
My dad was a local DJ. He DJed in different clubs and places like that, private parties. Right today, he still have a basement full of albums.
Does he really?
Yeah, man.
And what neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in the Austin area.
Okay.
The Austin area and still resides in the Austin area.
Okay.
Today, I moved back. I left the city once I came home, but then I moved back to the city because... And I work in the city. I work at BBF Family Services.
And tell us what that is.
BBF Family Services is a great community where we work with the population that's in the community. We work with, we run a reentry program. We mentor youth and adults, and we help the family. Holistically, we work with everybody.
And for the band, you're drummer vocalist.
I am.
Tell us about your entry into drumming.
I've been playing since I was, about 8 years old. And my first set was a Mickey Mouse set. My dad bought it, and I went through it on Christmas. So he kept me influenced, you know, with, you know, giving me the instruments, and I kept playing, and I fell off for a while, and you know, going to work and doing other things, and but kind of stayed in the music. I never left it. Just stayed in it. Just started singing more and less drumming, and you know, now I'm singing and drumming.
Now, Jim, yes. How did you find this band?
Well, the whole thing started in my studio. I should say, when you're making records, the quickest part of the process is recording. The rest of the time is editing and mixing, and you're alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a kitchen behind me, and I leave the TV on all day.
This is your Evanston studio.
Yeah, I never watch it. It's just on sort of for background noise, you know. So one day I went in to get a drink of water, and the show comes on the Discovery Channel called On the Case with Paul Azan.
Who I went to high school with in Naperville, right?
And it was about this guy, William Dillon, and I caught it from the beginning, and I was so intrigued, I watched the whole thing. Now, Bill Dillon spent 27 years and 9 months in prison wrongfully, and he was finally exonerated from DNA. And he started writing songs in prison.
I read that on toilet paper.
Toilet paper. His first song was on toilet paper. Yeah. And it had 16 verses because he had nothing but time. I called the Discovery Channel. And I said, I want to help this guy. How can I get a hold of him? I want to make a record.
And how long ago was this?
This was in 2010, I think. Or 9, maybe. I can't remember. Anyway, so they put me in touch with the Florida Innocence Project because Bill was from Florida. I told them who I was. They checked me out. They called Bill. The next day, Bill called me and said, of course, I want to come to Chicago. So we made a record, and it turns out Bill is really good. He wasn't just some guy. You know, he was really good.
Now, when you say that, qualify that. How do you know he was? You've worked with a million people.
Yeah.
How do you know he was good?
He could sing in tune. He had a very rich voice. He was a decent songwriter. He's a good songwriter. I helped him with that a little bit. We co-wrote a lot. And now he's a much better songwriter now, but he's a really good singer. He sort of is reminiscent of Johnny Cash. He's got that sort of presence. Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
He does. So we made a really nice record. That same year, the Innocence Project has a convention every year. That year was in Cincinnati, and they invited Bill to perform. So he gave his record out to everybody, and he performed, and everyone loved it. Barry Scheck, who is the lead, is the head of the National Innocence Project. Barry Scheck was one of the OJ attorneys.
Uh-huh.
He was really taken by Bill, and he and Mark Gotze, I believe.
Mark Gotze.
And who's the girl in Washington? Can't think of her name. Kate.
Kate.
Yeah. What's her last name?
No, that's okay.
All right. Yeah. Well, they sort of got together.
She's going to kill me.
And they introduced Bill to these other musicians, Antoine, and said, you guys should sort of.
Now, explain that. How did they introduce Bill to you guys?
Well, the conversation came up that, you know, with Laura Caldwell, she was one of the pioneers of it, and we was having a conversation, so she put it out there. You know, I have a drummer here in Chicago. Anybody interested in being in the band? So we just, everybody contacted us, and next thing you know, we were together. We've been together ever since.
That's why I forgot to mention Laura was involved in the beginning too. Yeah. So anyway, so one of their first gigs was in Chicago at Loyola Law School.
Okay.
So they all came to Evanston, my studio, rehearsed. I went to the gig with them, and it was a disaster. And it wasn't that they played so bad, but nobody was paying attention. They're all law students, judges, lawyers, and they're all drinking, talking to each other. And
free alcohol.
There could have been five monkeys up there playing.
Yeah.
So after the gig, remember, we came back to the studio.
Right.
And I said to these guys, I said, you know, this is the wrong platform for this. You need an audience to give you their undivided attention.
For sure. Yeah.
And I said, playing bars and these cocktail parties, this is not the deal. So I think the best way to showcase this is with a stage play.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I want to get into that. We're going to take a break from spots. I got so many questions for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. We were we are talking here. So, Jim, pick up what you were talking about. You were talking about stage play.
So I was saying, you know, their first gig didn't go so well, and my suggestion to them would do a stage play where they could tell their stories, sing their songs, and interweave it, and, you know, with multimedia and create a really cool thing, you know. And so everyone thought it was a great idea. I started talking to theater companies in Chicago. And everyone thought it was a great idea, but they said, where's the script? Where's the stage plot? I said, I produce records, you know. So I started talking to some writers. And as usual, you know, a lot of the writers were interested, and then I never got calls back. So it sort of fell by the wayside.
How long ago was that?
That was 6 years ago.
Okay.
So fast forward to last fall. So Bill Dylan was in with me recording his second record. And in Evanston, and he said to me, Tools, next week we're doing a gig at the House of Blues in Cleveland with the Exoneree Band. He said, come with me. We'll drive from here, from Chicago. So I went. And at that point, I knew all the guys. I had done a record with Ray Taller, who's the guitar player in the band. Okay. And Antoine has been to the studio and recorded with us. And
I hang out up there.
Yeah.
It's my other home.
Yeah.
So I basically knew everybody. So anyway, I go to Cleveland, and all the guys are there. Ray Taller, William Dylan, Eddie Lowery, Ted Bradford, and Antoine Day. They're the five guys. And a guy named Alan Fourier from the New York Times came to write an article on them for the New York Times. So he interviewed everybody, including me, and I was telling him about this stage play idea. And he said to me, boy, that's a fantastic idea. I'd love to write it. And he's a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He's a great writer. So that's sort of how the ball started again. So then Barry Sheck is involved with us. Jason Flom, who, by the way, has a wonderful podcast called Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Now, Jason Flom is a former president of Atlantic Records, Virgin Records, and now he has his own label, Lava Records. So he's gotten involved with us. Anyway, so we're trying to raise money with those guys and through a GoFundMe campaign. And the GoFundMe campaign, if anyone's listening out there, is GoFundMe.com/Exoneree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's spelled E-X-O-N-E-R-E-E.
E-X-O-N-O-R-E-E.
Yeah.
I've got it right in front of me. Yeah, right off your website. Yeah. And so the end game is to have this as a stage play,
which I think would be a great thing because they're and the most amazing thing about it, it's them.
Yeah,
they're going to be telling their story. It's not going to be one guy telling his whole story. They'll be interweaved with their songs, and it'll be a really fun and
it's going to be a beautiful
useful
musical
thing. Yeah. And I think the world needs to know more about this because their stories are incredible. These guys.
I want to take some time, Antoine. So after the news, mm-hmm. I want to get into your story. But as a unit, when you guys go out, do people, is there a fear of looking at this as a novelty act? I mean, how do you, in terms of production and stuff, how do you guys say, well, these guys are like really, really great musicians on their own, and besides what's happened in your past?
It's all about show and tell.
Yeah.
So, you know, people really think, you know, at one point thought we were just being paraded around and you know, being used just so people can have a sympathy, something to pat on. But that ain't what it is. You know, we come to really entertain. We come to doing things that we love to do. We come to support a community that hasn't been supported. We come to bring some awareness to the things that's happening today in our community. And it's not just happening to them. It's happening to all of us. So most people think this happens to them. Oh, it doesn't happen to us, but it happens to everybody. So we want to bring some awareness to it. Want to build a movement against it, wrongful incarceration, as far as women, shaken baby syndromes, and all these different other things they have just created just to incarcerate the people. So we're here for a purpose. Our purpose is through our music. We're going to touch a lot of people. We're going to make a lot of statements. We're going to get a lot of things done. So that's the reason Tulio has been a big piece in who we are and what we're doing today is because he's invested in it. He's invested in change.
I mean, this is staggering. I was reading this last night from the National Registry of Exonerations. Currently, 2018 exonerations, more than 17,610 years lost.
Get you some of that.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, get you some of that knowledge.
Yeah.
That's the knowledge that has been hidden a long time, because the word exoneree has just been put in the dictionary. You know, yeah. So had no place at one point. But now it does. So, yeah, just think of all the people that's there. And I had one guy ask me, he said, do everybody in prison say that they're innocent? The innocent guys don't say that they're innocent.
They know they're innocent.
They know they're innocent.
So there's nothing to talk about. You know you're going to be laughed at anyway. If you tell somebody you're innocent, well, how do you get in here if you're innocent? You know, but this crime happens to all different communities, rich, poor, all around the world. So that's what the fight is, and that's what this music does.
Got a couple minutes before the news. How would you describe the music? I mean, what kind is it? Is it rock? Is it soul? Is it R&B? Is it jazz?
Sort of all over the place.
You just named it.
Yeah.
And it's very real. It's really good. It's very real, and the band is real. The motive is real. So everything about it is real. To me, what I love about music, and my barometer is do I believe it?
Uh-huh.
No matter what it is, if it's happy, sad, or whatever, I believe this.
Music is truth.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. You write your own songs?
We do.
Yeah.
So you're going to play a song when we come back. Which one are you going to play when we come back after the news?
A song called Ain't My Destiny that Antoine and I and Bill Dylan wrote.
Yeah.
You wrote that all together? Yeah. Who comes to your shows?
Everybody.
Like at the House of Blues, who was there?
Everybody. Lawyers, people. I mean, people just came. We had everybody there. It was, you know, the audience was filled with, you know, a lot of big names, really. Mm-hmm. Too, they got to meet a lot of people because we were on stage, you know. So it was really great, man. It was really great. I hope we do it here as well.
Have you done anything like that here?
Just at Loyola.
Nothing like House of Blues
or just Loyola.
Space or anything like that?
Well, Bill and I played Space. Yeah. Bill Dylan and I, when we were making his record.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. And give us, before we take a break here, what's the instrumentation? What's the setup in the band? We got drums.
Two guitars. Well, three guitars and bass.
Okay.
And on the recordings, there's keyboards and some extra stuff. But the three guitar players, bass, and drums.
Okay. We're going to come back, and we're going to hear some original music from you guys. And then we're going to talk about your story, Antoine, after this, with David Jennings in the news on WGN.
The lawyers gathered and the writ was read. Bullshit and all those lies. The fate of the gavel and now I'm facing time. Cuffed and chained, taken to a cell. Doing life in this living hell. Trapped inside where the sun don't shine. Living on the edge, gonna make me lose my mind. Oh Lord, gotta find a way. Get down on my knees and I pray each day. Oh Lord, won't you hear my plea? I know in my soul it ain't my destiny. My precious high running through my veins. The days and months all fade away. Trapped inside these prison walls. I know what I gotta do, but can't do nothing at all. I walk this yard day after day. Trying hard not to lose my way. The walls are cold, the bars are steel. The prison guards, they shoot to kill. Oh Lord, gotta find a way. And I pray each day. Oh Lord, won't you hear my plea? I know in my soul it ain't my destiny. Destiny. Yeah. Yeah. Oh no. No, it's not my destiny. No. Bring it back to me. Yeah. Whoa.
gotta find a way. Get down on my knees and I pray each day. Oh Lord, won't you hear my plea? I know in my soul it ain't my destiny. Destiny, destiny. Bring it back to me. It's not my destiny.
Wow. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's Antoine Day on vocals and Jim Tullio on guitar. I don't want to get in the way. I mean, it was. We'll tell your story, Antoine. 60 years for murder, 25 years for attempted murder. That's what I read. So tell us, pick it up. I mean, September 1st, 1990. Tell us kind of what happened to you.
Wow. September 1st, 1990 was a day of hell. That hell just opened wide open, and I fell in it. I was contacted and told that, you know, the police was interested in talking to me about a case.
This is on the west side.
On the west side in the Austin area, at my home. And so I got in touch with a lawyer, because I know in Chicago you just don't walk in the police station. It don't always turn out so good. So I went in with an attorney who took me in just to take my money, and then he left me in the police station.
Well, this was let's set it up. I mean, there was a crap game. It says, I'm reading off this off the thing, a crap game outside a liquor store. And you were home, right?
Yeah. No, I wasn't even in Chicago.
You weren't even in Chicago.
Right.
I read you were home, but yeah, go ahead.
Right.
So what happened on the way?
So they you know, the story was told to me. So that it was a crap game. It was a $2 crap game, and somebody came to rob a $2 crap game. Mm-hmm. And that this guy must have got out a black vehicle. The vehicle was identified, so the police started looking at all black vehicles in the area. I only stayed maybe 3 blocks away from where the incident occurred. So my vehicle was parked in front of my home, and it was told to me by one of my neighbors that the police had ran my license plates. So that's how they knew it was, you know, that was my vehicle. So they associated me with the crime just because of my vehicle. But in this crime, to make a long story short, that this guy was 6'2", 250 pounds and light complected with long curly hair. You couldn't pour that into me, you know. And so, but when we got to the police station, I sat in this big open space with a guy over 40 minutes, maybe an hour. And me and this guy was holding a conversation until the detectives came up, took him to one room and took me to another. He went to identify a lineup that I was standing in, and he identified me. So it was so much corruption even in the beginning, you know, with the attorney, and then as well with the police, you know. It was just a mess, you know. It's hard to sometimes even forget what happened, as bad as I want to. But, you know, that's how it began.
A judge decide your case?
Yes. Which was another criminal piece, you know, because my rights was violated from the very beginning. And it was really hard to describe at first, because it was things that was taking place that I couldn't even identify, because I had never been in this predicament before. So my life began to change at that moment. You know, my kid's life, my mother's life, my dad's life, you know, my sister and brother's life, everything began to change at that moment.
You were convicted in 1992?
Yes.
You were exonerated in 2002?
Yes.
So where were you at? Where did you go?
I was in the county jail, the county jail. Then they sent me to Pontiac prison. Then from Pontiac, I stayed in Pontiac a whole bunch of years, too many, and then went to Stateville, another maximum joint that's treacherous. And from there, I was returned back to the county jail, and then I was released.
And how did the exoneration process begin for you?
Oh, man, it began by accident, because Mr. Joseph Howard, who I consider my angel, man, came in and said, hey, I'm going to take care of this case. But it started with my sister, Stephanie Day. My sister was at work talking to a coworker whose father just so happened to be a retired attorney, and said, hey, maybe you should let my dad look at this case. So he read my case and took it. He took it, because he told me he was going to be my lawyer. I didn't pick him. He picked me. And then he said he wanted me to be patient, that he's going to get me out. He see what they done to me. So, and he did, a little Jewish man from the north side of Chicago who I fell in love with, you know, and who was genuine. He was true. He was honest. And he came and did exactly what he said.
You got a new trial October 2001. Is that about right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But what, I mean, it's interesting. They brought witnesses they didn't have the first time around. I mean, what went wrong there?
I had another attorney who never identified witnesses. What? But the major piece to this, the two witnesses were the witnesses that said I did the shooting. Those were the guys who identified and told me and told and changed their story and told them that I didn't do it. So they knew who did it. The guy who did it is now incarcerated. So it's such a twist. It's so many twists. That's why this play is so important. You know,
there's questions I can ask that I can't even get my head around. I mean, seriously. I mean,
you can't. Yeah, yeah. How do you think I feel?
I know. But I mean, 10 years. I mean, so you knew you were innocent,
right?
So what was day-to-day life for you?
It was hell.
Yeah, knowing that you were innocent.
It was hell. And the worst part of it was watching my kids grow up, being in a place they, you know, you can barely touch, you can barely see, you can barely talk to them. I watched my kids grow up from the penitentiary. And it not only had effect on me, it had effect on my kids as well. It affected my mother's health. My mother worried so much because she heard about the killings and the things that went on inside the prisons. And it ruined her health. So it damages the whole family.
How old are your kids now?
My kids are, oh, man, if I tell that, they tell how old I am. You know? But they big enough to listen to this radio station.
Now, we were talking, we touched on this earlier, in the communities that you were in, mm-hmm. How many people are innocent? How common is this?
Man, let me tell you, I have seen more than 20 guys that I was incarcerated with that's now free. One of them, Sean Worrell, a friend, and he said, you know, he was down there suffering, would never talk about his case. He's free. He just got married a couple of weeks ago. You know, the man, people are coming home that people really doubt it. But when the evidence show 20 and 30 and 40 years later, it showed when the police first saw it. But they just denied us justice.
Well, statistically, it's 2 to 4%.
Yeah, 2 to 4.
And that's tens, if not hundreds of thousands, at least over 100,000 people innocent.
And that's the bottom line. That's the bottom number.
That's a lot of people.
You know.
So you were, came out in 2002.
Yes, 2002.
And then what'd you do when you came out?
May 9th of 2002.
May 9th.
It's coming soon.
Yeah. So what's the process like? I mean, how hard is it? What was it like for you to reassimilate yourself?
Oh, man, it was real difficult. It was real difficult. You know, I came through that system. Man, I'm talking about different adjusting and getting to know your kids. That was most important to me. I never feel as if I can ever spend enough time with them. I always feel like I'm making up. And sometimes I think that creates a space in between us because I want to give them so much. I have some beautiful daughters. I have some very handsome sons. And I have quite a few kids. But my thing has always been connected to them. And prison destroyed that for me, I believe. You know, I'm rebuilding it now. You know, I'm blessed and lucky to have the relationships that I have with my kids. And, you know, my mother ended up passing. You know, when I came home, I donated a kidney to my mom, who lived a few, you know, some years later. And she then passed. And my dad is still healthy, strong, you know, be 91 soon. He's dealing right now with some issues as well, health-wise.
But may I add, Bill Dillon and Ray Taller, who were on the band, Bill spent 28 years and Ray spent 29 years. They were denied of having kids.
Yeah.
They don't have kids.
Yeah.
And we had a gentleman in our band, one of the original members, that I like to give honor and thanks to, Darby Tillis. You know, he was the blues man. He was the preacher. He was the, you know, he was the best. And he's also on the album that Tools produced and wrote. And
he was originally in the band.
Yeah.
And he was the first Illinois man to be exonerated.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he's passed away.
He's passed away.
Let me ask you something. So you write, you co-wrote that song.
Yes.
You write.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you write in prison?
I did. I wrote a lot of things. I wrote a lot of stories, really. that yeah. that you know we could possibly turn into some songs. But I wrote some stories.
Well, what I'm hearing from you, I've never met you before, but I'm hearing your love of your children. Have you written stuff to them about them? Have you written the poems? Have you written songs about
your kids? I have. I used to send them poems, and I have some stuff that I'm gonna keep a secret because we're gonna break it out, you know, a little later, and gonna make some good music from my heart because my kids are my life, you know, and I thank God.
I hear that? Yeah.
The parents that they had, you know.
I have to interject here. Antoine spent 4 calendar years in the hole, in solitary, when he was in prison. 4 years.
So I had a lot of writing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I had a lot of things to talk about. So it's been a ride, you know. But I'm thanking God that I'm on this side of it. You know, where I'm conscious. I'm not destroyed mentally. You know, physically either. It helped me learn, helped me to recreate who I am and how I look at things.
And that's the other amazing thing about this band is every one of these guys, not one of them is bitter or angry. They all have positive outlooks.
How do you conquer that?
You know, being blessed with a great mom like mine who taught me, my dad who taught me, my brothers and sisters who supported me, my relationships, my kids, you know, that's how. Because, you know, when you look at how people allow society to destroy them, you do the opposite. I didn't want to just give in to the system because the system had already failed me. So I didn't want to fail myself. So that's the reason I come back to the community. And now I'm helping other kids. I'm helping other families way through it. I'm a court advocate. You know, I'm in court for the young kids when they get arrested to make sure their rights are not violated. You know, I also created a program called Life After Justice. Well, we support people who go through it. You know, there are so many things. Like he was speaking about Bill and Ray and Eddie and Ted. These guys, man, we support one another. We so tight-knitted. We're such a family. You know, we have our difficulties, you know, like every family will.
Yeah, right.
But we never lose grip. We never fall apart.
We got to take a break for some spots here. But was there church in your background?
Yeah.
I heard some gospel. I mean, yeah, there was, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of church in my background.
Yeah.
West my side. Whole family.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get one more song in before we split. So don't go away. We're going to hear more of this on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Minutes on, like hours, hours seem like days. Days feel like months, just wasting away. Nothing here to look at but this tired body of mine. Not much to hear, just my heart beating time. How in the hell can a person withstand so much pain? How can anyone endure and not go insane? Loneliness is torture, and torture is their way. Crush this human spirit bit by bit each day. Sometimes there's a light shining bright with deep inside. It brings me hopes and peace, eases my troubled mind. Loneliness is torture, yeah. Loneliness is torture. I spent 4 years in the hole. 4 years in the hole. I spent 4 years in the hole. My mind, my body, my soul.
4 years in the hole.
Antoine Day and Jim Tullio. It's Antoine Day on vocals, 4 years in the hole from the Exoneree Band. I've got so many questions, but I was told you one question I was going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you this. What was a day like? I mean, when you're 4 years in there, how does time, I mean, what's morning like? Can you try to describe that? When's morning? When's night? What's going on?
So, I mean, you can definitely tell, but when you're living in that environment, the day and the night doesn't even matter anymore.
Right.
What matters is that you get a chance to sleep, you get a chance to wake up, you get a chance to read, you get a chance to change your abilities, to strengthen yourself, your mind, your body, your soul. You get a chance to do some things, man. You get soul searching is really what it is, you know.
But that's a lot of soul searching.
And you have to be strong, right?
You have to be strong.
Gosh.
Yeah. Because you're treated like an animal.
Yeah.
You fed like an animal. You talk to like an animal. You come in, they violate you. They come in, you know. It's so many stories to tell exactly what we go through as a people being incarcerated. Because incarceration, man, is a terrible thing. And, you know, we talk about cruelty to animals. You have cruelty to human beings, you know.
What do you, you came out in 2002. What do you think about the developments with the Chicago Police Department since you've been out?
All the ones who's getting caught doing what they've been doing, I applaud the system. And finding the video, whoever invented these videos, God bless you. Thanks. Keep recording them because that's the only way the story is getting told. Because this has been going on for years. People have been, you know, it's hard to fight the long arm of the law. Mm-hmm. It's really hard, you know. So it's a great thing what's going on, but I don't want to separate us from and be separate, living a separate community. I don't want to just be against police because I'm not. I think there's great cops. I think the work that they do is great. I think the effort should be really. Should be really, 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 really focused is about truth and justice. You know, you can't do wrong because somebody else doing wrong. Mm-hmm. Two wrongs don't make a right. Mm-hmm. And it should be punished accordingly. It shouldn't be put aside because, and the major thing that I think should happen is when you get convicted, you lose all of your benefits. You shouldn't go to prison and still be able to retire and get your retirement benefits. You know, and it's great to say that my son has become a Chicago police officer now.
No, really?
Yeah, he is.
Wow.
Because he saw what happened to his dad. He wants to do something different. But that's one of the things that I think is great about this city and this movement that's going on right now. You get a chance to see a lot of things that you couldn't see before.
We got about a minute left. Talk about the May 11th thing. Jim.
We're going to be doing a live performance, a fairly short one, May 11th, for the Moran Center in Evanston. And that'll be Bill Dylan, Antoine, myself, and Eddie Lowery from the Exoneree Band.
And that's open to the public?
Yes.
That's open to the public?
Yes. I don't know the address off the top of my head.
Okay, well, the people can
The Moran Center, M-O-R-A-N.
And people can support the project, give the GoFundMe address?
GoFundMe.com/Exoneree.
How's it going? I mean, is there a time frame for this?
Like, no, but it's been very slow.
Yeah.
So we really need some help.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fantastic story.
The GoFundMe is necessary. Yeah. It's very necessary.
Yeah.
Because it's going to help this cause, and people should really get involved in that.
Well, Dan Long, we've never done something quite like this, but I kind of like to follow the story through. I was telling you during a break.
Yeah.
So maybe when the band comes back, bring you in, we could just kind of follow how this all progresses, how people respond.
Great.
So you're always welcome back to the show.
Great.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's
thanks for having
story,
us.
Your stories are really great.
Yeah. And I
usually don't
it.
Go this deep on Nocturnal Journal.
And then I love the view. The view is beautiful.
No, but you're always welcome back.